Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is the Reverend Terry Owens, General Minister and President of the Christian Church, or Disciples of Christ. Reverend Owens was recently elected General Minister of the Disciples of Christ, and she is the first woman of color to be the top executive of a mainline denomination. And before going into the ministry, her resume included more than 20 years in working in corporate America, leading diverse teams and data management before she entered seminary. Previously to becoming General Minister too, she was the Dean of Students at the University of Chicago Divinity School. In this episode, we talk about the impact that small churches can have and the necessity for authenticity and vulnerability in ministry. I hope you enjoy it. Well, welcome Terry Owens to the Failing Boldly podcast. I appreciate your taking time out of your day to speak with me.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and always happy to make people more familiar with our movement, the Disciples of Christ.
I noted in the beginning of the podcast, you've just been elected General Minister of the Disciples of Christ denomination. And I would imagine there are at least a few listeners who aren't familiar with your denomination or really what it means to be the General Minister. I don't know if you've humorously referred to yourself as the Pope of the Disciples of Christ or not, but I guess how would you describe what you do to folks?
Well, that's the sort of humorous reference, but there is no analogy that could be made to the kind of power that the Pope has in terms of sort of top-down. The heart of our denomination is really our local congregations, and so our congregations are self-governing. We speak of three expressions of the church, a local congregational expression. There's a regional expression that operates mostly on a geographic basis to provide resources, a regional minister, and sometimes one or more associates or a small staff that would provide resources and counsel to those local congregations, work on leadership development, work to facilitate ministry between the general ministries of the church who operate at a more national level in the U.S. and Canada and also internationally. Our current polity was constructed back in 1969. Before that, the disciples really were truly a movement, and I like that language because it speaks of what we're about beyond just an organizational structure. There were ministries that had been put together to collectively serve on behalf of those local congregations, and there were what we called area secretary or state secretaries who operated at on behalf of the wider church to those regional groups of congregations. But we have some of the vestiges of that kind of structure. We have a Christian Church Foundation that manages many gifts that have been given over the years to serve the wider church. We have a pension fund. We have what we call Disciples Church Extension Fund, which operates to provide financing to church for various capital and other development kinds of campaigns. We have Disciples Home Missions, which operates a lot of different programs domestically in the U.S. and Canada. So that general expression of the church does not dictate to local congregations. We don't appoint pastors. We don't appoint regional ministers. Each of those entities operates in a self-governing way to choose those leaders. They all have their own boards. We collaborate. For example, our Week of Compassion Fund is a place where all disciples will be donating and giving to support rebuilding efforts when we have horrific disasters like Hurricane Harvey. So our folks are on the ground, and we would collaborate across the whole denomination to support that particular ministry as it seeks to address. So the general expressions of the church hopefully are doing the things that allow us to collectively do what an individual or small group of congregations could not. And yet we have disciples from coast to coast in the U.S. and Canada, north, south, east, west, lots of different cultures, multi-racial, mostly African-American presence, Hispanic, Latino congregations, and pastors, and Asian pastors that are extremely diverse. The North American, Asian, and Pacific Disciples includes about 18 different languages, East Asian, South Asian, Pacific Islander, and we also have indigenous peoples, Native Americans, who are part of our denomination. So we're diverse, somewhat diffuse. I, as general minister and president, am thought of as the CEO of the larger general church, but each of those individual larger ministries don't report to me. I simply work and collaborate with them, but I am considered the lead pastor of the denomination. So trying in a way that reflects our real commitment to theological diversity, to speak where we have, in some cases, consensus, or in some cases, situations where some of us feel really strongly about issues and others do not. So that's always a fine line that requires a great deal of discernment. But we're many things, and we try to operate effectively together as much as possible while still leaving room for theological diversity, as well as embracing all the other dimensions of identity that make us all unique and worthy human beings.
Yeah, thank you for that background. You know, you've had a diverse background yourself, working in the corporate world for IBM and Blue Cross Blue Shield, doing consulting and working in information technology for more than 20 years. And I was reading through your biography and found a sentence in there that I'm sure has a bigger story involved. It says, despite professional success, she felt God had another assignment and accepted her call into ministry. And I would imagine that didn't happen just over a weekend. So I was wondering if you could talk about the process of shifting from what I think would see as one distinct vocation into another, and how that went for you.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a process that took several years. I think when most people have what, you know, ministers call their call story, the common element of sort of struggle and saying, oh, God, really? Or are you sure? You know, I was always a very active lay person. My grandfather was a Baptist minister in Terre Haute, Indiana. So I grew up very active in the church as a child, as a teenager. During my college years, I wasn't as active as I think most college students probably are not. But once I graduated from college, I became a really active lay leader. And even as I was working and traveling and, you know, building my career, and I received my call. I was living in Indianapolis, and at the time working for Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and I really struggled with it because I thought that if I wanted to do it right, I would need to go to seminary. How would I continue to, you know, work, earn money? I was at a certain stage in my career where the idea of making less money was not really attractive. And so all of those, you know, with my son, we had a son who was, I think when I accepted my call, he was 5 or 6. We eventually wound up relocating to Chicago so that I could attend the University of Chicago Divinity School, which has an affiliate institution known as Disciples Divinity House. And as I began to take each step, I hadn't realized that Disciples Divinity House had really important funding for disciple students. And so that took away one concern. I interviewed for another position at another company just to help a friend of mine who ran a search firm, and discovered that the leaders of that institution thought it was great that I was headed to divinity school, were willing to give me the flexibility that I needed to work and to go to school during the day when I needed to. So I was working for a Fortune 500 company with a group of leaders who really valued what I brought to the team and supported the pursuit of my particular goal. It wasn't an MBA, had nothing to do with the business world, but they apparently valued me enough to say, we think that's great, go do that. So I found that as I started to take steps toward what I thought was probably going to be almost impossible to do, opportunities presented themselves, and I actually took a new job that gave me a 10% increase in pay, whereas I thought I was going to have to give up money, and I had a work environment that was flexible enough for me to be able to go to school and continue working and supporting my family. And my son has no real memory of me being anything other than a minister. So I'm glad he's not scarred in any way because mom was busy, you know, doing a lot of things. So I guess the learning that I have from that is that when you really feel many of us are afraid to make big changes, and I found that as I just took small steps, that God revealed the next step and the next step. And I look back and I wonder how it all happened. But in my journey, I used to tell my students at the Divinity School, my journey is not going to be your journey. You have to figure out what God is preparing for you and how you'll move through it. So it was, even after I accepted the call, it took another 2 or 3 years before I actually got up the nerve to apply to Divinity School. So I have a real heart for people who are in a position where they're feeling a different kind of call or leading. And I know how hard it can be to make the life choices that sometimes those callings require us to make. And I'm still making less money 15 years after leaving the corporate world than I did then. So it's a choice I made. And as I tell everyone, God has really kept me and provided for me during that time. So it's you know, it all worked out, but it was certainly a struggle.
Yeah, I hear that. I mentioned earlier that you're the first African-American woman to, or I should say woman of color, to lead a mainline denomination, and you're the second woman to lead the Disciples of Christ. I'm wondering if you could talk about the process of seeking this particular position, the general minister position, and the discernment process you went through to decide that this may be where God is leading me.
You know, I don't think that I would have pursued it on my own had I not had friends and colleagues, and even some students who reached out and supported the idea. I have been active as a disciple since I was in college, and been on lots of committees and served on boards and participated in a lot of the work of the church in the last 12 years or so. When I was at Dean of Students at the University of Chicago Divinity School, very connected to the higher education institutions of the Disciples, and particularly Disciples Divinity House. But I just had a lot of friends, and it warms my heart to realize that those friends were Black, white, Asian, Latino, male, female, young, old, a few retired, older white ministers who have been mentors of mine, who were encouraging me to consider being a candidate. A lot of people who contacted me, there was a process where you could either apply or be nominated. And I did not put forward my name, but other people did. And so I was informed that I had been nominated and been invited to apply. And because I'd been having conversations, people knew that Sharon Watkins was nearing the end of her second term. We have a term limit, if you will, of 2 6-year terms. So we knew there would be an election of a new general minister and president. And I really applied because of the support of other people. And it required me to kind of discern what this was really going to be about. What did I do? There were a pretty extensive and lengthy executive search process, where I had to put forth a vision document, answer several questions on paper even before I went through a few rounds of interviews before I met with the general board and then was affirmed as the nominee to be put forward. So I knew that if I were elected, it would be historic, but it wasn't a case of my deciding, oh, that would be cool if I were the person, let me go and do this. I had lots of conversations about with people about what it would mean. Was I really the right kind of person? Would my personality and my style be effective in the culture of this organization? And I think the common thread that people felt was that I would be able to bridge not only a lot of cultural differences, but that my business experience and my consulting experience that had given me certain skills about understanding and analyzing organizational dynamics and structures and processes would be a set of skills that would be very helpful for the church. as well as my real commitment to ministry and the gospel and the mission work that we do in the world. So it was a lot of conversations with a lot of people. And then once I was in the process, I was pastoring a church in Downers Grove, very happy with that congregation, had been at the divinity school. So I also knew that if I didn't get that position, I was still doing very fulfilling and rewarding work. So it was probably one of the less stressful search processes that I've ever been involved with. And I was really torn. I didn't want to leave my congregation in particular. And my prayer was that, okay, God, if this is what you have for me, please make it really clear. And then when I was selected as the nominee and then subsequently elected, I knew that God, and I told the congregation, God will not bless me and not also, you know, bless you. There's a proverb, that says the blessings of the Lord make rich and he adds no sorrow to it. So, I was pretty philosophical about it, and that may have been psychologically a way of kind of cushioning myself in case I wasn't selected. But, I think overall I tried to really open myself up to the possibilities and be very prayerful. But I had a lot of friends and a lot of counsel about whether or not it was a good thing, whether or not people thought I would be capable and whether I would be considered, you know, an appropriate candidate and whether I would be able to garner the support of the whole church. And it happened. So I trust God that this is what was supposed to happen.
Yeah. As you know, the focus of this podcast is on failure. And one of the things that intrigues me about your story is, again, your experience in both the corporate and church worlds. So I'm wondering if you could reflect on how failure is perceived in both of those cultures.
That's a really good question. And I think depending upon the corporate culture, failure, I think healthy organizations allow room for failure and have both human development and process development protocols in place that do give you some space to sort of try and fail. In the corporate world, particularly in IT, I remember a situation where one of my database administrators who was new to the company was having problems, and we were noticing that certain processes that would load fresh data overnight into our data warehouse reporting environment, some of those processes were failing. And this particular employee came from a culture where to fail meant you brought shame upon yourself, upon your family. And he was very reluctant to be open about it. And we used some forensic processes to figure out, okay, who was running the jobs that were failing. And after some conversation with this employee, tried to instill in him the fact that in this context, we were always trying new things and new ways to solve problems, and not every one of those things worked. The idea was not to worry ourselves about when things didn't work, but to keep looking for the solution that did work. So that's one understanding of failure in my own career in terms of helping people understand where we must have room to fail in order to get to good solutions. There are, within the corporate world, if your performance is being evaluated and you have certain, sales goals or other development goals, there's one, management approach that says if you fail to hit your numbers on a regular basis or you fail to meet these particular objectives, you are considered to be a failure. And we now have, and you might be removed or you won't get the next promotion. When I worked at a large, IT technology manufacturer, and we had, marketing reps who had quotas, and I got bonuses for helping people solve problems. And if you weren't making those kinds of marks, then you were considered just not really moving forward. You had to have the right mentor in the right place and somebody charting out what the next step was. And if you weren't making those steps, if you decided that a particular level was fulfilling to you, then, you would be considered a failure. And in the church, I think we accept We think of failure, I think, in a very different way. Too often, denominations within the Christian faith look at success around the number of members that you have. So if you aren't growing at a particular rate, or we're not constantly seeing you developing new members, more members joining your church, or your budget is not growing, then a lot of times ministers will perceive themselves as having failed. And then we have a different perspective that says, what about the spiritual health of your church and your organization? What kind of mission activity is that church doing? I pastored a relatively small church that had been through some difficult times before I became their pastor. And I used to joke and say, before I count you, I need to weigh you. I need to understand what's the quality of the spiritual life that we have together, and how can we look at what we're actually doing in the world. That small church of about 50 people still puts on an annual back to school fair that reaches anywhere from 600 to 700 people, with school supplies, free food, games. We were blessed with a lot of land, but if you saw that congregation on Sunday morning, you would never in a million years think that a small group like that could pull something like that off. And so how we measure success, if somebody looked at the statistics of the number of members, they might say, oh, well, Terry, you didn't grow that church to large numbers, but that church is doing the kinds of ministry that some larger congregations have not been able to organize themselves and inspire themselves to do. So both corporate world and the church world sometimes fall into a game of just measuring by numbers. But I think that the mission of both an organization is, if they're looking at themselves closely to see what is exactly that we're trying to do, what is our philosophy about how we want to grow and develop our people. A good example of this is the Gallup organization developed a new way of doing a skills assessment called Strength Finders. And usually when you do performance reviews, you have, you know, you've done this well, you've done that well, how well you're meeting expectations, and then your development plan is based on, oh, you're not doing this well, you're not good at this, so we're going to spend all of our time helping you to do what you're not good at, or make you better at what you're not good at. Strength Finder says, let's figure out what you're really good at, and then try to leverage that within the organization. The question I always ask myself, and particularly now in this new role, what's the highest and best use of Terry Horde Owens, both from the perspective of what my role is, but also the perspective of what my particular gifts and graces are. And I think in the church, that's a really healthy way to think about, you know, pastors who come out of seminaries and maybe they haven't had a lot of education around financial management. They may not know how to read financial statements, or they've never managed people and are not familiar enough with how one needs to engage the human dynamic part of an organization and how human systems work within organizations. Just because you're a fabulous preacher doesn't mean you're going to be a great administrator. Just because you're a great technical person doesn't mean that you're going to be a great senior leader in an organization. So the highest and best use of people, I think, is a common approach to looking at how people are made and developed and what we can do to best leverage their strengths. And usually you're good at what you're good at. You like what you're good at, rather. So if you let me work in an area where I'm really playing to my strengths, I'm going to be not only more effective, but I'm going to be, you know, have a greater sense of satisfaction about, you know, what it is that I do. So that's kind of my philosophical thing about failure. I think if we go by the numbers and sort of immutable kinds of characteristics, as opposed to thinking about what is it that we're really trying to do, and are the numbers helpful in us measuring it, or do the numbers become an artificial mark that sometimes makes us blind to really what the underlying goals actually are?
Yeah, you know, I wonder, I guess in my own reflection on churches, there's always this focus on hitting the numbers. Maybe this is similar in the corporate world too, hitting the numbers for, say, worship or budget or small groups. And then faith communities can fall into the trap of comparing themselves to other churches and they may try to keep up with the folks in their neighborhood or another church in the same denomination in the next town over. And then they try to be something that they're not, and they miss out on the process of discerning who are we in this particular church and what do we do well. And once they get a sense of that, I think once they get a sense of that and really take that to heart, then they can take risks and fail in that way because they have a better sense of who they are.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. My husband serves as minister of music of a really large Baptist church on the south side of Chicago that has about 15, 16,000 members. And being familiar with that kind of context and environment, one of the things I had to be really careful about when serving a smaller church was that I knew there were a lot of cool things, right, that these large mega churches could do, and I was never one who was suspicious or poo-pooed mega churches, because I always, as an African-American woman, the church has always been an institution that provided a particular scale of resources to really be effective in the community. So I've always seen, the large church is really the way to go because it helps us be really, just sort of have a mass and a scale that might not be possible with other institutions in the Black community. But pastoring a smaller church, we had to ask ourselves exactly the question, who are we? What is it that we're called to do? And that back-to-school fair, when we first tried it, people thought, well, we were in DuPage County, Illinois, which is at one point, and I think still is, the highest per capita income county in the state of Illinois. And the thought was, well, who will come? Who will need school supplies? Who will need this free food, et cetera? And we did 100 backpacks the first year. They were gone in like 15, 20 minutes. And that church began to see that right there in their backyard where they thought there was only prosperity, there was great need. And we've, over the past 8 years, we saw kids kind of growing up, coming to that fair, and families coming back again. And the church began to see that with the help of community partners, and local businesses, we could get the resources that we needed to really do an effective job and grow it to the point where we're now giving away over 500 backpacks and seeing 700 people that we can feed and entertain and do haircuts with and bringing hospitals to do health screenings and all that sort of stuff. And it's an older congregation. We had a developer that was going to build a senior living center adjacent to our property. The local village planning commission vetoed that idea, but we were prepared to say, okay, God, if you're going to place a senior living center next to us, what does that mean in terms of the ministry that we now can do and are able to do? We had a couple that was really excited about a ministry of to an orphanage in Belarus and got us excited about it, educated me about it. And this little congregation now supports with several thousand dollars a year. We've bought playground equipment, computers, put about 30 kids a year into a 10-day camp in Belarus. It's like this little church. Who would have thought? But taking people's passion and figuring out, is that something we can do? And we may not be able to run a 24/7 food pantry. We can't host a homeless shelter because we don't have enough people here, but we can plug into the countywide homeless shelter system called PADS, and we can offer support for a few weeks during the year with what we have. What can we do? And in my experience with that congregation was that they feel really good about what they were able to do. And I think figuring out what it is that you're good at and what you can do and do well gives you a great deal of satisfaction. There's a text that says, the harvest is many, but the laborers are few. And so sometimes you have to figure out which vineyard is your appropriate vineyard, where it is that you're supposed to serve. And doing smaller things is not necessarily a failure or doesn't mean that you're not able to do bigger things. It's just that you've been positioned and equipped to plug in here and maybe not there.
Mm. Do you think churches spend enough time figuring out what their vineyard is?
I think too many churches spend more time trying to figure out how they can get new members, right? What is it music? Is it kids, you know, children and youth. We want to address young families. And I think everybody is trying to figure out how we can ensure that the next generation isn't turned off by the church. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and church was one thing then. And I remember what used to be radical to have a guitar or drums in church, and now you almost can't imagine in some places not having those things. Camp used to not be a thing that people did, and now it's, you know, within the disciples' tradition for many years, people, it was a key aspect of a church life, and now we're finding that camp attendance is declining in many areas because young people just aren't as interested in those kinds of experiences, particularly if they didn't have parents who had those kinds of experiences. So everyone's trying to figure out what's the next best thing. My response to that is that we have to listen to the next generation. They connect to institutions and organizations differently. They think of employment differently. It used to be that you worked at a company for years and you built a career and then you had a retirement. And now people are a lot more transaction oriented. I'll work for this little startup, and if that doesn't work out, I'll move over here. I like this deal here now. I'll be a contract freelancer. I'll start my own company. Lots of different ways to think about employment over the long term, and it's usually, not anymore at least, sitting within one company and just climbing the ranks. So I think we have to understand how people build relationships and connect to organizations and institutions and what it is that people are searching for in terms of spirituality, and how can the gospel of Jesus Christ not only reach that, but in what, how do people want to come together in order to live that out or collectively build a strong spiritual environment? My observation is that generations, I won't say young people because I think I'm still very young, but people who are younger than I are interested in making a difference. They're more altruistic. I came of age and started working in the early 80s where most of my college classmates were lawyers, doctors, stockbrokers, investment bankers. And now people are really thinking about careers in a way that will satisfy them and make a difference. You still have people who are motivated more by financial success, but even in the midst of that, they still want to be able to make a difference. And we've got to figure out how, as church, we can capture that fire, instill in them what we believe is one of the most powerful messages of the age, that Jesus calls us to love God and to love our neighbor. And that we need to be working for that kind of justice in the world as a response to that love. That if we can capture people's hearts with that message by showing them that the way you do this is not just by singing from a hymn book on Sunday, but by getting out and, you know, giving money to organizations like Week of Compassion who are helping in a hurricane, or doing tutoring programs with young people, or working against human trafficking, or showing up to lobby against important issues in D.C., but also maybe spending time in a small discussion group exploring the sacred text and understanding how that can give you the kind of spiritual maturity and depth. Small groups that might spend time in solace, in solitude, in silence, different ways of doing spiritual practices that might give you that kind of personal fulfillment. All those things, I think, are part of what church needs to be paying attention to as we seek to be relevant to the spiritual and community needs of a society that's changing drastically. The next 20 years belongs to the people behind me. And I want to give platform to those people who are thinking about ways in which church and the message of Jesus can be relevant. We have to listen to them and make room for them to tell us where we need to go.
Absolutely. Listen to them. And then, I guess, to go back to what I was mentioning earlier, to listen to oneself and discern what makes sense for our context and our gifts, rather than just trying the hot new thing in ministry to reach young people if that might not be a fit for them. You know, you mentioned earlier that we need to build up that fire. And in my experience of trying to build campfires, it takes several tries before you can really get anything going.
Exactly. And it takes, you know, a lot of listening. We We're very eager to go to conferences and listen to that latest, greatest thing. And then we, as you've been repeating, and it really resonates with me, we really have to know ourselves and know, who we are. I was able to do, I think, a lot of things well in the corporate environment. And I have never felt, there are lots of things I could do. I could learn a lot of things. I would teach people about technology, consult. I enjoyed all of that. And I think some of those gifts of just being able to learn and listen quickly and teach people, I think that teaching gift became clear to me pretty early on. I used to think maybe I was supposed to teach in a seminary, but I think the gifts in ministry that were always evident when I was in the corporate world have given me great satisfaction because I'm in a context that values those gifts in a particular way, and I can use those gifts in a way not to hit the numbers or make money, but to help people really find themselves, who they are. And, still as the church, we have a mission, right, an organizational mission that Jesus gave us to share his gospel and make disciples. And he said, if you love me, then feed my sheep. So we have these broad goals. We're the ones who've created all of these other human targets that sometimes get in the way of those broader goals and creating cultures that are sometimes antithetical, to those goals. So I look at myself and said, I've always been able to do certain kinds of things well, but there's something about the pursuit of these particular goals that kind of fills that hole in your soul. And so I felt very comfortable with my transition over time. And people who know me are like, you were once an IT consultant? Like, really? I could not have imagined that. And yet I did that and had a certain degree of success in doing that. So we have a lot of things about us that are skills that are capable, et cetera, even soft skills that can be leveraged in a lot of different ways. And paying attention to what really brings you satisfaction is so, so important, because you can do a lot of things, but you, I think, are intended to find fulfillment and satisfaction probably only in a very few things.
Well, I want to close with by asking you what I often ask guests, and that is to share a story about failure, and that can, for you, they can either be in the corporate or the church world.
Well, I think I have an example, and as I was thinking about that question, it struck me that I had made the same mistake twice in both environments. I was a fairly young consultant at one of the big six consulting firms. I was sent out to, and this was a time when people were just starting to use personal computers, and working for a large supermarket chain that wanted to somehow automate some of their record keeping. When people were first starting to use spreadsheets, so we were building the spreadsheet model for them. And there were two problems. They really didn't want to make the investment in the technology so that enough people could have the personal computers to use this tool, and there was real cultural resistance to making the shift. And I was, a lower-level consultant who was just brought in to run it, and I spent a lot of time trying to convince people that what their superiors had decided was going to be good for them would be good for them, and I was here to do this. And we spent almost a year on that project before the partner that was on the project finally pulled me in and said, they don't really want to do this, do they? And I said, no, they don't. and had I spoken up and had I really been listening, I could have shared that message a lot earlier. And it taught me never, always listen, really be paying attention. What you think is cool and great, maybe cool and great. There are times when you need to push past things to make change happen. But after a while, you have to sit back and say, this isn't really what they want. And if they're not willing to embrace it, it's not going to be successful. So listening, and then also being willing to share that feedback with other people as we were working together as a team was an important lesson I learned. And that project was perceived by the client as a failure. And fortunately, I wasn't punished for that, but I think it was a real learning that we failed the client because we didn't really listen to what they wanted to do. We think this would have been really good for them, but it wasn't the right time. They didn't have the right resources. And so we erred by trying to force it on them, and we walked away looking like the bad guys. In my congregation, when I first went there, you know, disciples congregations, we, you know, elders are important. They're usually teachers and spiritual leaders, lay leaders within the church. And in my home disciples church, the structure of the elders was that you only reached the status elder when you were sort of a more seasoned person. And a lot of the, pastoral care that was done to assist the pastor was done by the deacons. So we were doing a sort of a right-sizing of our church council, our board, and I suggested, I said, I think we need to reserve this title of elder for people who really, you know, demonstrated a particular kind of spiritual maturity, people that we look to for teaching and counsel. And then the people who would serve these shorter terms, those would be the deacons. I've not been in a church where I see the elders turn over every few years. And so we tried it, and every meeting that we had with deacons and elders was always an exercise of, like, trying to remind them of what was what and who was who. It was so hard for them to move past what they had been doing for so many years. And that wasn't the only problem. It was beginning to impact their ability to do the work of ministry overall. And so I called my first leadership retreat, and I said, Terry, you just got to acknowledge that this didn't work. We had the leadership retreat, and people were a little concerned to come to the meeting, and I think it was because they said, well, we tried the last thing she suggested, and this isn't going so well. What's she going to say this time? And so I just laid it out in front of them, and I said, you know, I don't feel like this is working. What do you think? And there was just a huge exhale in the room. I said, let's just go back to the way that you were doing things. I said, I had in my head a vision of how I thought this should work, and it's really not working here. And I said, until we figure something else out, let's just return to the way we were doing things. And from that point on, we had an awesome rest of our retreat. The fact that I admitted that I was wrong and that it wasn't working, I think, really gave me credibility. And it didn't stop our ability to try new things in the future. If I had not been willing to admit that it wasn't working, I think I would have lost credibility really forever with that group. So I've learned to listen and pay attention, but also to admit when I'm wrong, to admit when my idea didn't work. And I think those are really, really, because if you lose credibility and if you lose trust, then it's hard to leave.
I think that's really true. I think, you know, churches that are wanting to reach younger generations, this has been our experience here at Urban Village, is how key it is to be authentic and to be vulnerable and to admit mistakes. I think in working with younger generations, this is huge. And so I think you've appreciate your leadership in that area. Well, Terry Owens, thank you again for spending some time with me and sharing out of your own experience. I'm really grateful for your ministry and have no doubt that you will have a big impact, not just on the Disciples of Christ denomination, but on movements of Christ in general, and look forward to seeing how those kinds of collaborations will take place.
Yes, our ecumenical and interfaith work is really an important part of our DNA. As a church, and that the ecumenical work that I'll be engaged in as general minister and president is something that I'm really looking forward to, and I hope that disciples will no longer be such a secret, and that people will see us moving in the world with love and working for justice right alongside our fellow Christians and other communities of faith. So thank you for the conversation. I've appreciated getting to talk to you.
And that is this week's episode. Thanks again to Terry Owens for speaking with me. You can learn more about the Disciples of Christ denomination by going to disciples.org. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with Eugenia Cheng, mathematician, musician, and author of the books How to Bake Pie and Beyond Infinity. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening. That's this week's episode. My thanks again to Matthew Vines for speaking with me. And you can learn more about him and the Reformation Project Conference in Chicago by going to reformationproject.org. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with Wendy Snyder and Bill F., popular radio personalities on WGN Radio here in Chicago. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.